Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm your host, John Tanza, in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Friday, March 13, 2015. A retired UN officer says South Sudan can draw lessons from what happened in Sierra Leone and Liberia more than two decades ago.
When Nigeria saw that the rebels could not win, too, the government also could not win, they just reached the solution that for the interest of Liberia, the two should step aside.
And a joint Japanese South Sudanese cleanup begins on the Juba Nabari Road.
So as we approach the raining season, we need to start the cleaning so we can have awareness to the community on how they have to keep it clean.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. A South Sudanese retired United Nations officer who worked for more than 10 years in various United Nations missions throughout Africa says South Sudan's conflict has a lot of similarities with the conflict in Liberia and Sierra Leone 25 years ago. Peter Tingwa says the West African Regional Bloc, the Economic Community of West African States, pressured leaders from both countries to step aside for the sake of peace. He says the leaders of the two warring parties in South Sudan must either solve the ongoing crisis in the country immediately or face UN sanctions. He notes UN sanctions did bring peace to West Africa after a bitter conflict in that region.
In Liberia, when we were there, the ECOWAS was the one that was mediating the facilitators. And at that time, President Obasanjo was there. He was the president of Nigeria at that time. When Nigeria saw that the rebels could not win, too, the government also could not win, they just reached the solution that for the interest of Liberia, the two should step aside. Then the resources of Liberia were also, like timber and gold, were sanctioned. They had to follow a regime called Kimberley process in order to sell their gold. So by excluding the protagonists, it was possible to totally dismantle the rebel army and the government army and build a totally new army, not carrying the baggage of what is in the past.
If you look at the Liberian scenario and you look at what is happening with the South Sudan peace talks in Addis Ababa. It has been on and off for a year, and time is not on anybody's side. Is that situation applicable to South Sudan?
I think it should. After all, the Security Council is finally responsible for peace and security worldwide. And ECOWAS made full use of that by asking for sanctions. So Liberia was under sanctions. You see, its economy was controlled. The tailor and the rebels were barred from getting new arms. Those sanctions were so as to make these people toe the line.
A lot of people in the region are saying IGAD is not independent because one of its members, Uganda, has troops in South Sudan. So they are saying the independence of IGAD is being compromised. What about in the case of ECOWAS in West Africa, where some countries involved?
Fortunately, in Liberia, all the people, the countries there, were united in bringing peace. Because as long as the war in Liberia was festering, the neighboring countries were suffering. So everybody agreed that as long as the protagonists, the led rebels and Taylor's government, so that nobody was on thy side from the neighbors, it became easier to solve. But indeed, if God are siding with one or the other, it will complicate the thing and make solution very difficult to find.
If we apply the Liberia scenario to South Sudan, we all know that Charles Taylor is now in ICC, you know, answering for charges. Is this going to happen with President Kiir or rebel leader Riek Machar, if you take that scenario copycat?
We don't know as yet. But in Liberia, the difference was there was the monitoring of human rights. Reports were written. Individuals were identified and so forth. So that's what led to indictment of Taylor and in Liberia. And in Sierra Leone, it was the same. Individuals, rebel commanders, and even this morning I was listening to BBC. One of the government militias was jailed 10 years and is just released today in Sierra Leone. So the sanctions and the international courts and something, these are instruments which are used in order to whip people in line.
You worked with the United Nations for quite a long time, 11 years. A lot of South Sudanese are wondering if UN is to impose sanction on South Sudan, how would it be implemented? Who is going to be policing? Who is going to be the police to watch and see that these sanctions are really effective?
If it is like travel ban, then there is a sanctions, let me just call it department in New York. They know the individuals. So if they want to travel, for example, somebody of Taylor wanted to travel to Cote d'Ivoire, he would have to come to the UN mission. And then the UN mission would inform the sanctions committee in New York, and he would be granted permission to go to Cote d'Ivoire. They would be allowed to go, but they would have to travel with the permission of the UN. One of the things that annoyed in the Sierra Leone, annoyed Fode Sanko, was Fode Sanko left Sierra Leone and went to South Africa on his own. South Africa was requested, and he was taken from there back to Sierra Leone. So travel ban, freezing of assets so that they don't have money to travel, and then a regime imposed on the resources. These are instruments that are used very common. It's not the first time if and indeed it is applied. It's not the first time.
That's Peter Tingwa, a South Sudanese retired United Nations officer who worked in humanitarian, political affairs and Department of Peacekeeping in Somalia, Liberia and Sierra Leone. He was speaking to me from Nairobi earlier today. The Japan International Cooperation Agency, or JICA, and the Juba City Council are working together to clean up the Juba Nabari neighborhood. As VOA fellow Lucy Pony reports, the road has fallen into a sorry state in the 18 months since it was built with the help of the Japanese government.
JICA Public Relations Advisor Atong Dimach says a recent visit to the road by Japanese officials prompted the cleanup effort.
The Japanese ambassador, as well as some of our officials, went to visit the roads and see how the community is maintaining the roads. And we were not so impressed with the results because all the roads that we built to make it easier in the raining season are all blocked by all the dirt and the thing that they're throwing on it. So as we approach the raining season, we need to start the cleaning so we can have awareness to the community on how they have to keep it clean. That will be useful for them more for the rainy season.
Before the road was built in 2013, the Juba Nabari community was often flooded during the rainy season. That meant residents had limited access to other parts of the capital and suffered from waterborne diseases. When the road was built, it included concrete culverts to help with drainage. But almost as soon as the Japanese handed the road over to the local community for maintenance, Dimach says it fell into disrepair. She says the culverts are now filled with household trash and sand and no longer serve their purpose. She says they need to be cleaned out before the rainy season starts, which could be as early as next month. Dimach says Juba Nabari residents will join Japanese engineers deployed with the UN mission in South Sudan, or UNMISS, and South Sudanese officials for the cleanup operation.
We will have a participation from a number of the community's representatives and volunteers from Juba Nabari community, as well as about 40 soldiers. And we also have the participation of the mayor of Juba, Mr. Christopher, as well as Japan ambassador to South Sudan and JICA chief representative. The first, it's tomorrow, which is the 14th, as well as on the 21st, next Saturday, and on the 28th. So it's a 3-week cleanup campaign.
The Central Equatorial Ministry of Physical Infrastructure and the UNMIS Japanese Contingent Engineer Company built the Jubanabari Community Road with technical advisory support from JICA. Construction on the Maram roadway with its concrete drainage culverts cost more than $1 million. JICA says the road benefits more than 3,000 households in Jubanabari. Dimash says it is the duty of residents who use the road to maintain it. For VOA News, I'm Lucy Pony.
From Juba, we moved to Jonglei State. State officials there presented an $80,000 check to Bor County officials yesterday to be used for construction of a primary school in Malou Village. The funds are part of a $115,000 donation from the government of East Timor. As Jacob Achek reports for VOA from Juba, the money was originally granted in early December 2013, just days before South Sudan's current crisis erupted.
In 2013, the government of East Timor, a Southeast Asian country also known as Timor-Leste, donated the $150,000 to Bor County officials to build a primary school in Malou, a village in Bor County called Nyang Payam. The school foundation stone was ceremonially installed by the Prime Minister of Timor-Leste, Kairala Agnana Gosmop, on December 5, 2013, 10 days before violence broke out in South Sudan capital Juba. Jonglei State Minister of Finance Dano Obango said that's why the project is only recently getting underway.
Now when we came, the money was in our account, and then we asked them also for certain technicalities. They need to do the like a contract with the contractor. We need the statement of account. We have that.
Bor County Commissioner Mamer Rook says the digging of the Malou School Foundation has already begun, and a committee comprised of five people had been sent to Buffalo Bank to transfer the U.S. currency into South Sudanese pound.
We have received the check from Jonglei State, Minister of Finance. The money were donated by the government of Timor, by the Prime Minister, to construct Malou Nik Primary School. And after the construction of the school, the donation will never stop.
He said once the money is converted into South Sudanese pound, the committee will immediately transfer the first installment of funds into the constructor account.
The money are not to be released once. The first phase should be released direct to the contractor, and second phase is going to be released direct to the constructor, and final phase should be released direct to the contractor. The money will not stay in our hand and will not stay in our account.
Jonglei State Education Minister Tut Kwon says the school construction and other education projects were delayed because of the fighting.
The crisis deteriorated the infrastructure of education in Jonglei State as a whole because of the crisis. I think the need of schools that are affected is so huge. With this grant given to construct, I think that will also address some of the issues and challenges related to education.
Under the contract, the school construction will be completed in 1 year. Commissioner Rook said the contractor is one of the several companies repaired through Intersource, a humanitarian agency working in Jonglei State. While many companies bid for the contract, Rook said they choose Nandre Construction Engineering Company, which has already built six other primary schools in Bor County. Rook said due to the ongoing insecurity, none of the primary schools located in Bor counties or the five Payam are operating, except those schools located in villages along the River Nile and in Bor town. The government of East Timor has also pledged to build a hospital in Bor County at some point in the future. East Timor population is about 1 million people, while South Sudan has a population of nearly 10 million people. East Timor was internationally recognized as an independent nation on May 20, 2002, following a United Nations administrative transitional period. 9 years later, South Sudan became an independent state in 2011. For BOA News, I'm Jacob Achek in Juba.
You're tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. A political activist is missing in Zimbabwe. That story is coming up after this break.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today.
Do you think the educational system prepares students for the job market?
No, I don't see. More especially, like, I can give you a very simple example. As per now, I'm talking, we are preparing for our exam, but the university is closed some time ago, but they tried to open because the lecturer were demanding their money and they were not paid.
That is what it is supposed to do, but unfortunately in our country it doesn't. Education in our country is purely theoretical.
Yeah, to a lesser extent, I will say that the education system in our country can prepare we, as the youths of the country, for better jobs. But to the lesser one, because we have just come from wars, and we have 3 years of independence, and we have lacked so many things in the field of education.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus. We now turn our attention to Zimbabwe, where opposition lawmakers stormed out of a parliament this week after debate was blocked on pro-democracy activist who was abducted on Monday. Civic organizations say they are shocked that African states have remained silent on the disappearance of Itai Zamara. As Sebastian Mwofu reports from Harare, rights groups say they will ask the African Union and South African Development Community to remove President Robert Mugabe from chairing those bodies if his government does not act on Zamara's disappearance.
Zimbabwean police say the wife of Zamara last saw her husband when 5 men forced him into a car before driving off on Monday. Since then, the opposition and civic organizations have been accusing President Mugabe's government of being behind the abduction. This is because the activist had been staging protests to force Zimbabwe's 91-year-old leader to step down for failing to prop up the country's economy. In Parliament this week, Vice President Emmerson Mnangagwa denied allegations that Harare had an issue with the missing activist.
We are a democratic society, and anybody in this country who commits crime must account for the crime they commit. This is why we have the institution of Zimbabwe Republic Police to deal with those who commit crimes of this nature.
On Friday, a High Court judge ordered Zimbabwe security agents, including the police, to ensure that the missing Zamara is released or brought to court. That followed an application by Zimbabwe lawyers for human rights who are leading efforts to locate Zamara. Simeon Mawanza of Amnesty International says there is every reason to worry about the missing Zamara, despite assurance from Vice President Mnangagwa that the abductors will be brought to account.
Zimbabwe has a history of abductions, and most of them were politically motivated. In 2008, dozens of Zimbabweans were abducted mainly for their political activism. Some were found dead, others were seriously tortured.
One of those lucky to be alive is Justina Mukoko, the head of Zimbabwe Peace Project, a civic organization that documents cases of human rights abuses. In December 2008, Mukoko was abducted from her home under the cover of darkness and spent 3 weeks in an undisclosed location where she was routinely tortured by state security agents. Mukoko says the abduction of Zamara has been very unsettling for her.
I think for me it's really frightening that after my case, the government would actually continue to abduct people in the same way that they have abducted Itai Zamara. I cannot express the fear that I've got in me because it's like I'm walking the same route that I walked from the 3rd of December 2008.
Mukoko is part of the group that wants to approach regional bodies such as SADC and the African Union to dethrone Mr. Mugabe if Zamara is not found. Mr. Mugabe is the current chairman of both bodies. The civic organizations noted that no African government has voiced concern over the missing activist. Sebastian Mofu for VOA News, Harare.
And now a horrifying story about witchcraft and albinos. Albino people living in Malawi are in a state of fear after a recent spate of attacks there. Some have been abducted, others killed, and their body parts have been removed. Lamek Masina has more on this disturbing story from Blantyre.
About 15 albinos have been reported abducted and killed since January in various parts of the country, many of them in the eastern district of Machinga. Gideon Nahum is the officer in charge at Machinga Police Station.
Machinga is still continuing receiving reports of attacking and kidnapping of people born with albinism. As of yesterday, we had also received a certain case from Nawichi that a two-year-old girl was kidnapped. Fortunately, members of the general public assisted until the kidnappers dropped the child.
Nahumu said about 13 suspects have been arrested in connection with the incidents in the district. Attacks on albinos have also occurred in southern districts of Mulanje, Nsanje and Chikwawa, as well as in Blantyre and Cheu district of central Malawi. Albino people whose skin appears pale because of lack of a pigment are targeted in the belief that potions made from their body parts bring good luck and wealth. Chairperson of the Association of Persons with Albinism in Malawi, Boniface Massa, says the development has ignited fear among albinos.
Our major concern is the security aspect. Most of us, we are now living in fear. We can't do our things freely because we are not sure who to trust, even our own relatives, our own neighbors.
Massa says in areas where cases of kidnapping are rampant, children with albinism have stopped going to school, while women with albinism are staying indoors. Enifa Foster is a resident of Makunami village in the southern district of Chiladzulu. She told VOA the incidents have forced her to carry her three-year-old albino granddaughter wherever she goes. She says she makes sure that she is with her granddaughter wherever she goes, and she even don't allow her to pray at neighbors' houses as was before the incidents. When she goes to the church, she says she carry her on her back and drop her at school and bring her home herself after classes. Ian Simbora is the national coordinator for the Albino Clinic at Queen Elizabeth Central Hospital in Blantyre. He told VOA that fewer people with albinism come to the clinic to get free sunscreen. He says without the lotion, they are risking their lives to skin cancer.
Every week, I have to have people, not less than 15 going up, that come to benefit from the service that we give to people. But just 3 to 4 weeks ago, I've come to realize that patients that I've seen, they are not more than 10. And everybody who comes here would always tell me, we are afraid to even move out. Even some, they even told me that they are not even allowing children to go to school.
Minister of Home Affairs and Internal Security, Pochi Bingu, says there are not enough police officers to protect people in their homes. Chibingu adds the government has strengthened community policing, knowing that those who are involved in the kidnappings live in the community. In a Tuesday statement on the surge in violence against people with albinism in Malawi and elsewhere, the UN High Commissioner for the Human Rights, Zaidi Rad Al Hussein, asked authorities to prevent the attacks and bring perpetrators to justice. Lamik Masina for VOA News, Blantyre.
It is estimated about 27 million people are displaced every year by natural disasters. A new report says the problem will get worse with more frequent extreme weather events and developments in hazard-prone areas. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
Internal Displacement Monitoring Center Director Alfredo Zamudio says disaster-related displacement has quadrupled since the 1970s. In other words, the risk of losing a home to hurricanes, floods, etc. is 4 times greater today.
That is the dimension of the problem, how disaster is displacing people more and more. It's a huge problem and it has to be addressed.
The center has released a new report called Disaster-Related Displacement Risk, Measuring the Risk and Addressing Its Drivers. The report was released in the run-up to the third UN World Conference on Disaster Risk Reduction. The summit is being held in Sendai, Japan, from March 14th through the 18th. Zamudio outlines the reasons for increased displacement.
The main risk drivers for this development has been population growth in hazard-prone areas, the rapid and unplanned urbanization, the unequal distribution of wealth. Also, it has to be said, in certain areas, weak governance and the state failure.
The report says Asian countries have the highest risk of displacement because people are exposed to multiple natural hazards. These include what are called mega events that affect many people.
Mega events are more than 3 million people per event, and those are increasing in number, and they are affecting most people in Asia.
Zamudio says these include the giant typhoons that have hit the Philippines in recent years.
People in a country like the Philippines and in other areas of Asia who are living where urbanization is growing very fast, where they are living in very poor conditions in hazard-prone areas, let us say a riverbed of a beach closer to where the big waves may come, those people will be affected very, very hard, more and more and more frequently, unless something is done very quickly with their situation.
Small island states such as Antigua and Barbuda, Haiti and Cuba are also among high-risk countries. The report also says 30% of the pastoralists in northern Kenya, southern Ethiopia and south-central Somalia are at risk of being permanently displaced by 2040. That can happen, it says, even if climate change does not make droughts more frequent or severe.
The risk for displacement has three components: hazard, how people are affected by it, and the vulnerability of people. So climate change affects one of them, affects the hazard, the frequency of the hazard, and the strength of the hazard.
Zamudio says conflict and violence further increase the vulnerability of communities.
You have the situations like in the Sahel, where people may be affected by drought, they may be affected by floods, and they may also be affected by violence and conflict. These are the toxic cocktail for permanent displacement of huge amount of communities.
The Internal Displacement Monitoring Center recommends adoption and enforcement of land use plans and stronger building codes and diversifying and strengthening the livelihoods of the poor. It says the global community must address disaster risk and sustainable development simultaneously, including efforts to end conflicts. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
That's our show for this Friday. We now leave you with the song Bandito by Emmanuel Camilo from Western Bahar Ghazal State, who sings in his native Balanda language.
Dakateba kontang nangai tiwono teno yo bandito ninde. Dakateba kontang nangapanga wono teno yo bandito ninde. Modi well not is in a bibanga. Modi well not is in a birunga. Modi well not is in a gota. Moda well not get an editai banome. Dakaba matino ninde. Moda well not get an editai banome. Dakapa matino ni ninde
ani da ngo damru ngo tarango no
tene no sono ti de kada uta bano
anga so ni meditize
my vi na de no pingan da uta bindi fu no badir yo no ai tuta ki tito tele no bandito duta matani no donze ti a bindo no so ni ta mar bone tan zon bonita se yi ni ta zoko di sale wi ta lebo ke yi bo bi du no bo de piti kalombo ti du ti zo zuru na so Nazangwe ya bi kambe del badu de kata soko na del baku del babe na delo bi binabo dize na tono liboni da wali tando bo miti delo te yelwo veni no kabandi bo dize na kumu rete do tizi endu no so kene ata bili do wabai wati bimuro ni bedele bandi bo ni bazi na deke zondo.
We have been listening to Emmanuel Camilo with the song Bandito. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Have a peaceful weekend, and we hope You can join us again next week for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.